Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to the Jazz on the Tube podcast series. We've got a guest that I wanted to have for a long time, and I finally had a good occasion to invite him to join us. He's going to talk to us about Cuba, which he knows quite a bit about and has been to many times, legally, of course. And he is also going to talk about his newest book, and we'll talk about a little bit some of his other books, too, briefly. We could easily spend an hour just talking about some of the biographical details, some of the things that he's been involved with over the years, but I'm going to do a quick, short version. Our guest, Ned Sublett, is a composer, guitar player, producer. If you know Afropop, you've probably heard his work, extensive work on Afropop. And if you want to have some fun, Google Ned Sublett and Afropop and hear some great, great interviews, including one with Donald Harrison. Note that name. It's going to come up again later in the call. His books, which I love and I recommend to everybody who's serious about digging deep into the history of music, Cuba and its music, The World That Made New Orleans, and then sort of a memoir of his time in New Orleans before the flood. And as an advisor to Levees.org, Ned, I got to thank you for calling it the flood and not calling it Katrina, because it had little to do with Katrina and everything to do with levee failures. Ned, let's just jump right in. For people who are going to Google and maybe take up some of these suggestions, look up Ned's books, Ned's last name is spelled Sublett, just like subletting an apartment, but add a T and an E. So if the word Sublett...
Two T's and an E, that's right.
Two T's and an E. So... Ned, so much to talk about. Let's, if we may, before we talk about the new book, I'd like to talk about Cuba. Now, you've been to Cuba more than a few times. I had the number in mind. I think it's over 20?
I've been there 26 times, and I just got back last month. I went down for Billboard magazine, which was an assignment I did not expect to have, and I hadn't been to Cuba in 12 years. So it was impressive how quickly the old friendships and contacts leaped back to life, even as I tried to comprehend what had grown up since my last visit.
Wow. Now, it appears that the Cuba door is opening again. You know, a lot of Byzantine stuff going on there, but...
It does appear that that is happening. I mean, and I hope that the infrastructure gets put into place as sturdily as possible before some act of sabotage can happen, because this has always been entirely vulnerable to the political winds. President Carter got rid of the travel ban in the 70s, but Reagan put it back, and then we didn't have it. And then we had the travel ban for decades more. So this can all be undone tomorrow, which is why we all need to support this action and insist that it's a good thing for our government to do.
Excellent. So those of you that write your congressmen and your senators and the White House, definitely let them know we want to be able to travel.
You are in favor of lifting the embargo of Cuba. Because what a lot of people don't understand, and it's very important to get this out right now, the travel ban has not been lifted. The embargo has not been lifted. The reason they haven't been lifted is that there are laws, both of them signed by Bill Clinton, that forbid the president from lifting them, but make it a matter of legislation. So the travel ban can only be undone by an act of Congress, and the embargo can only be undone by an act of Congress. So in many ways, the president's hands are tied. However, he's come up with some creative solutions to it. And the 12 categories of travel to Cuba, for example, there are 12 allowable categories under the law in place. And what he's done is basically put that on the honor system. And, you know, if you want to go, you can probably figure out a way one of those categories applies to you, and there's no will to prosecute. So, in effect, the travel ban has been, if not lifted, at least to some degree, softened. But it's still not legal to go to Cuba as a tourist. Just go for purposes of tourism, hang out on the beach, smoke cigars, nothing else. That's still not legal. The embargo is still in place, meaning most commerce with Cuba is still illegal, but various changes have been being implemented in this by administrative action. So there's things possible that have never been possible before. And for the first time, we have an administration that's acting favorably toward the idea of things happening. Now, there's a lot to keep relations from developing. And there's certainly no reason to think that American corporations are going to be running Havana anytime soon. But there's so much that it has been hardened in the U.S.-Cuba relationship that it's going to take a while to chip away at all the pieces.
Okay. All right. So those of you that want to see this happen, you need to be activists about it, because there's, as Ned pointed out, there's a lot of things that could work that are already working against it. Ned, let's assume that this goes well and Americans, United States citizens, can again travel to Cuba. I know this is a huge topic. People have written guidebooks because, you know, Canadians and Europeans and South Americans can go to Cuba. But very short, because I know we want to get to your book, how would you advise people that are getting to Cuba for the first time? What should they look for? I mean, we're talking about people that love music, in particular love jazz and Latin. I know it's a big question.
Well, they should definitely read Cuba and its music, from the first drums to the mambo.
Okay.
I say that flippantly, but I actually do highly recommend my own book for understanding this subject. But you're going to Cuba. Where do you want to go? Oh, my Lord. There's a lot of music going on in Havana these days. It really depends on what you want. The problem is there isn't a single listing service. So the way you got to deal with going to Cuba is to, A, spend enough time, which means take a lot of money because it's not cheap. Spend enough time there that you can kind of start to figure out what's happening and benefit from word of mouth from people you get to know. That it's really hard to come in and have instant gratification. Oh, you'll have fun. I mean, step off the plane and you'll be hearing music pretty quick. But, you know, the good stuff, you got to find your own way into it, and that takes time. A few shortcuts. You know, you can, if you want to hear timba, which I love, you know, you can go to one of the two Casas de la Música, which have matinees from 7 to 9 and midnight shows 7 days a week with different bands. So there's any day there's like 4 different bands that you can go here, right? Just at that, you know, just at those two places. You know, jazz clubs, La Historia del Cuervo on La Rampa. There's other jazz clubs as well. You know, if it's a weekend, you have a lot more choices. There's usually sort of bigger name gigs. The big music these days, the one that's really making the money and has created its own industry is the reggaeton. But the reggaetoneros in Cuba play with, you know, bands of 10 pieces behind them. So, you know, you're likely to hear some good music by accident. To hear the right music, invest a little time in it, and you'll find your spot.
Great. And I want to recommend Cuba and its music. Cuba has such an powerful impact on the music of the United States. We're not even aware of all the different ways it influenced it over the years. And that
I always say that it's been a world capital of music since the 16th century.
Exactly, as your book discusses. And it had a big influence on New Orleans. New Orleans and Havana were huge trade partners and cultural partners, and of course the Havana-New York connection.
And it's very exciting right now to think that New Orleans has been approved for direct flights to Havana.
Wow.
Now, whether there's an operator who's really going to pull it together and get that happening is a good question. And there's a big limitation on what you can do with tourism to Havana right now, because Havana is already at hotel capacity. So, you know, it's going to take a few years to ramp that up. We can't, you know, we can't just send vast numbers of people without places for them to stay. So I hope that the New Orleans link, however, will get this ancient link of Havana and New Orleans happening in a contemporary way. The two have been sending music back and forth for so long. It seems like this. Every Cuban musician I've spoken to loves New Orleans. You ask them about their experience in New Orleans. A lot of them have played there, Jazz Fest or somewhere else. You ask them, and they just kind of smile.
And, of course, New Orleans has a deep Spanish history that a lot of people aren't aware of. They think more of the French influence, and you cover that in The World That Made New Orleans. Your other massive tome, in the most positive sense, by the way of saying that. These are, again, you know, there's music, but, you know, music is not a disembodied thing. It comes from history. It comes from flesh and blood people. And the more you know about the history and the people involved, I think the more meaningful the music is. And I think that's certainly how it's been for me. Speaking of that.
That's right. Music is a text. Music is a way to read history if you've got ears to read it with.
And speaking of that, your latest book, not about music, but about a very important context out of which the music came. Can you tell us a little about the title, when it's due out?
Yeah, the book, which out? is The book, which is co-bylined with my wife, Constance Sublett, is called The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry, and it comes out October 1st from Lawrence Hill Books. We've been working on this book for 6 years. It's been a very draining book to write, but I'm very happy that we did it. It's about the slave breeding industry. It's a long book. It's 35,000 words longer than Cuban. It's music, which was already long. So it's going to be, 750 pages. And it tells the story from the earliest arrival of enslaved Africans at Sapelo Sound through emancipation, of how slavery in the colonial and Republican United States developed into a system in which the birth of an enslaved child created money that created credit, that fueled the entire engine. The capitalized womb, as we call it, was the ultimate input for the Industrial Revolution.
And this is something that we have not faced. You know, we always look at it as, you know, an institution limited to the South and limited in the scope and so on, but economically that's just not true.
389,000 is the best number we come up with. Some people say 500,000, but somewhere in there, let's say 389,000 enslaved, kidnapped, captive Africans brought to the present-day United States territory. That's less than 4% of the hemispheric total. 4 million came to Brazil, right? Barbados, which is the size of Queens, took more Africans than the entire United States. More slave ships came to New Orleans from the east coast of the U.S. than from Africa, because what we had in the United States was a slave breeding industry. The Africans were only the seed. By 1860, when the southern states started to secede, there were 4 million enslaved African Americans, grown from about 389,000 African, and that growth was itself an economic expansion because people were money in the slaveholding South. It's a horrific story. I think it's the strongest material in American history. That's what we've been working on.
And the most censored in many ways. Everybody knows there was a slave time in the United States, but people know very little about the mechanical details of it.
And people have this idea that it was like Mandingo, you know, this sort of lurid bestseller from 1957 that took place on a fictional slave breeding farm. It wasn't quite like that, but it was a slave breeding system. Every child that was born was worth, depending on the place and time, $75 or $100, which meant not that they were going to be sold right away, but that the farmer who legally owned the child had $75 or $100 more new collateral at the bank, new credit, which was to say new money that he could draw on. Every move to expand the slave nation into new territories revalued slave owners' portfolios upward. That's what annexing Texas was about.
And that's what I think maybe even the invasion of Mexico about too, and taking all that land. You know, it's just a small thing, but people should know, Mexico abolished slavery, I think, in 1810.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get around to it until 55 years later, and of course it wasn't permanently, perfectly abolished. There were a lot of incidents of slave labor going on right through into World War II, the coal mines in Alabama being one example. Let me ask you this. Now, you're a musician and a composer and a music booster and so on, and you've written about music before. Why this particular topic, coming from your point of view?
Well, I've never viewed music apart from the world it lives in. And the music that has seemed the most important to me over my years of working, my 25 years with Afropop worldwide, of learning the music of the diaspora of Africa, is intricately intertwined with the history of slavery. And the more I looked at it, the more I realized to what a degree the history of slavery is the history of the hemisphere. That's not a particularly profound observation. I mean, lots of historians have been writing about that. But I think that was one way or another, getting into deeper and deeper levels of that understanding through music. Just pulled me right there. I don't feel that music is absent from this book. It is actually there. We mention music, you know, here and there where it's appropriate, but because music is part of life and music is gives you a picture of what's going on in a way nothing else does. And whatever documentation we have of the music before the era of recordings is very, very valuable. There's a very touching scene in the book. I mean, to me, it's very touching. During the liberation of Sherman's March, when this story is actually told in a book by Noah Andre Trudeau. Hang on, let me see if I can find it right here for a second.
Sure.
Here we go, coming right up. Da 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 da. Don't go away. There we go. I'll just read you this little moment here. Noah Andre Trudeau quotes a letter written during the campaign by General William P. Collins of the 1st Division that described what happened on one occasion when the band came through playing the stirring John Brown's Body, which was the popular anthem of the Northern military bands on Sherman's March. Quote, this is from Noah Andre Trudeau, about a dozen young African-American girls came out of nearby houses. Quote, formed into a ring around the band at the head of the column, and with a weird plaintive wail, danced in a circle in a most solemn, dignified, and impressive manner, close, wrote Carlin years afterward. Quote, what that meaning was I did not know then, nor do I now, but I, of course, interpreted it as expressive of goodwill to our cause. And Carlin was hearing Ring Shout, a collective song of spiritual power sung and danced in a moving counterclockwise circle, one of the oldest known forms of African-American music, heavily Congo in influence. The idea that, this is me speaking again, the idea that in this moment of liberation, these young women came out and danced a solemn ring shout in honor of the soldiers and of their liberation. It's just, to me, it's a very stirring image.
Because, you know, the deeper I get into, my interest is in jazz, and the way I like Latin music too, and the deeper I get into the history of it, the more I'm just struck by, this is a chronicle of survival against all odds and against unbelievable obstacles and hardships, post-slavery too, of course. Obviously things didn't suddenly become better right after slavery was abolished. And so when I'm studying music, you know, I'm thinking of what the players went through to establish themselves, to get an education, first of all, to find their way into employment as musicians, to keep their bands together, to travel through the South and deal with that. There's a very important human dimension, which I just think enriches the appreciation of understanding the music. So this narrative that you've captured, which, you know, you say a lot of historians are, you know, clear about this version of history, but the official story obviously is anything but, you know.
Well, I think historians understand. I don't think we're saying actually anything that historians are going to disagree with. We'll find out when the book comes out. But I think what's different about this is the questions that we're asking. You know, every generation you have to write history over again because you have to ask different questions of it at different moments. Mm-hmm. And these are the questions that we need to ask right now.
Well, yeah, and there's, you know, and that's a theme here too, is there's a new generation all the time that needs to be educated, that needs to learn the stories of what happened, that needs to learn the art, that needs to learn the survival skills.
And I have to say that historians have been doing an excellent job of that. The civil rights era, whatever else it was a historical revolution. It was a revolution in American historiography. We started to fill in the gaps after that. Generations of scholars have been on it now since the 60s. And the scholarship is continuing to advance as miserably treated as they are, the new generation of graduate students and young historians is making important discoveries, which all enrich our complete understanding, to say nothing of the revolution in knowledge that these new tools for searching have brought us. So we're able to interrogate history now with a fund of information at our fingertips that we've never had before.
And you captured a lot of this in your new book.
I hope so.
And with your wife is sharing the byline on this.
I can't tell you how satisfying it is to be able to share a byline with my partner of the last 40 years, without whom I would not have done any of this, because she was kind of my history teacher over the long years. This text is something that together we have theorized and researched into existence. It's something that all these years we've been finding, oh, did you see here it says in this book that, oh, and did you know this? And really the book grew out of our constant conversation.
So even though you and Constance worked on the book for 6 years, it's been in the making for many, many years, longer than that.
Oh, I think it has. But we really made the decision to go full-time on it in fall 2010 when I got a marvelous fellowship from the TV Star Center for the Study of the American Experience at Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland. And it took me a while to learn how to say that. But we went to Chestertown, this marvelous historical town in Maryland, and lived there for 8 months with access to a private research library. It was an absolutely watershed moment in, I think, both our comprehensions of this material, even as we were beginning to write, draft out the book at this time. So from 2010 on, this has been the main project for both of us. I had to occasionally break and do other things. I got this fellowship that I've been working on for 4 years that took me to Angola, a place I'd always wanted to go, into Haiti. So in 2012, I had to stop for about 6 months and do that. Constance kept going. Constance kept just jamming away on the 1830s. And as though we step aside for smaller other projects, this has really been the job. So we're bringing a lot to the table with this one.
Yeah, yeah. And in reference to your trip to Angola and other places, I do recommend people Google Ned Sublett and Afropop, and you've got a great, I think it's a multi-part report from Angola.
Oh, yes, there's a four-part series of audio documentaries called Hip Deep Angola. 4 one-hour documentaries, each quite different from the other, so if you don't like one, try another one. I think probably the best one from the point of view of listening is the last one, which is about the Cuban intervention in Angola as told through music. But the number three was really the reason I went all the way to Angola, was so I could go to Mbonso Congo, the historical seat of the Congo Kingdom, when the missionaries arrived in 1491 and converted the Congo King to Catholicism before Columbus crossed the Atlantic.
Wow.
I went to that spot and worked with Barbaro Martinez Ruiz, the art historian who's been doing unique work there since the late 1990s. Absolutely mind-blowing experience, which may or may not form the core of the next book. Certainly something I'm still thinking about every day.
Okay. And speaking of next things, related to the new book, you are in the early stages of developing a project around the book, a musical.
Yes, I'm hoping to develop a musical version. This might not seem like an appropriate book for music, but actually I think it's a good project for music. The book's in six parts. Parts 2 through 6 are the chronology. But part 1 is designed to be read aloud. It's in a little different language. Focuses a little less on the sequence of political events and a little more on the experience. And that section of it I want to develop for a group of multiple reading voices and live music. And I asked my friend Donald Harrison if he would do music for me, and he said he would. So at the moment, I'm trying to see if I can raise the funds to get it produced nicely at some key locations in the places that matter to our story,
mm-hmm.
but also any place else that wants it.
Yeah, and I hope everybody knows who Donald Harrison is, but you know, you can know who he is and still miss a huge part of his story. So let's talk a little bit about Donald and why he is, you know, the perfect colleague to develop this idea. Well, obviously from New Orleans.
Yeah. Well, Donald Harrison, I mean, he was the obvious person for me to go talk to because he's someone first that I know personally, somebody that is a figure that commands high respect from pretty much everybody, everybody in the society, everybody in the music world. Donald is the kind of person I always hope to collaborate with, the best people I can learn from. And I wanted to see if he would dignify this text with a musical response.
Mm-hmm.
So for Donald was the sort of the center of the last chapter of The World That Made New Orleans. The World That Made New Orleans is about colonial New Orleans. But the last chapter was about the first Mardi Gras after the flood. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to see Big Chief Donald Harrison of the Congo Nation come out of St. Augustine's at 7:30 in the morning, which was a way of saying that New Orleans was alive among everything else it was. It was an extraordinary moment of spiritual rebirth for me, I felt. That I wrote about in that final chapter of the book. And it's when I realized that the next book could take music, my only thought was to ask Big Chief Donald.
Mm. And when we call him Big Chief, that's not just a charming nickname. There's depth to that.
Yes. He's an Afro-Orleanian cultural practitioner. He doesn't really like the term Mardi Gras Indians, as I understand it, which is what they're typically known as. He doesn't mask Indian. He masks African. It's not really for me to explain what he does, because he's the, you know, he's the guy who does that. And he does it when he plays. His alto plays, one of the greatest alto players in the world right now.
Yeah.
I just heard him blow down the house at Blue Note the last week with a bunch of guests on stage, but he was definitely the ringmaster. It was always rooted in New Orleans, but it was also slashes of all kinds of different styles, which is also a very New Orleans kind of thing. And it was done like it was going to be fun. Not like, oh, well, here's some really advanced music, but he's playing, you know, this Charlie Parker's Cherokee at breakneck speed, as he put it. Very few people can imagine doing what he's doing, right?
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's like, it's fun.
Yeah, I went to the Friday Late Show at 10, I think mm-hmm. it was. And yeah, it's just, it was like three or four shows in one.
Mm-hmm.
There was some bebop, there was a lot of fun New Orleans music. One of the music director of James Brown Band
mm-hmm.
was there, and they did some James Brown numbers. The guy that co-wrote Sissy Strut was there.
Yeah, Ocean Talley was there. Fred Wesley was there.
Yeah, I mean, wow.
And Christian Scott, Donald's nephew, who is a bona fide trumpet star now and sounds incredible playing that bebop trumpet alto duo with him.
Yeah, don't miss it. If you get a chance, I don't know if he's going to do that show again in other places, but if
I have no idea.
Yeah, if anybody gets a chance, well, just see him anyway, no matter what he's up to. But if that show comes around, just stop everything you're doing and make sure you go. So you're talking with Harrison about this project and about writing the music for it. So
yes.
I tell you, I'm so interested in this. I wanted to interview you about it and let everybody at Jazz on the Tube know about it. We have a lot of generous members who help Jazz on the Tube keep going. And this is something I'm very strongly personally behind. I like I said at the beginning of this call, the music is not disembodied. It comes from human beings. It comes from history. And the more we understand and respect that history, the more we're going to appreciate the music and vice versa. And obviously this is going to take funds and donations and contributions. And I would like our Jazz on the Tube, we're good at stepping up to step up for this. Now we're in the early stages. And so probably the first step would be to write to Ned, so he can have you on a list so that as things develop, he can form. Can I talk about your mail list? Or that?
Yeah, and this is the very early stages, too. This is the first time I've talked about this in public. I haven't written a press release. I'm not doing anything like that right now, and I don't plan to do crowdfunding, you know, type stuff. I'm just trying quietly to raise the funds to do the musical version.
Okay, well, you're hearing it here first, and as things get closer, we might even do another call about it when we have more details. But if you're interested in it now, and now's the time to get interested in it, I recommend that you write Ned and let him know that you're interested. Start a dialogue maybe about what's possible for you, and as this thing evolves, so you can be part of it. I see this being a major cultural watershed. We're taking history that sort of known, but not really known in detail, and exposing it to light of day in a way that perhaps has never quite been before, and combining that with the power of music, especially Donald Harrison, and what he's going to bring to it, it can't help but be an important thing. So how do people get in touch with you, Ned?
I think the best way is through email, which is what I'm on all day long. Since I'm a writer, I'm always staring at my computer, so I'm on email the whole time I'm awake. And my email, let's use ned.sublett@gmail.com.
Great. So ned.sublett, S-U-L-E-T, like the word sublet with an extra T-E at the end.
And an E.
T-E.
Two T's and an E.
Two T's and an E.
S-U-B-L-E-T-T-E.
Okay. @gmail.com. And, you know, if you might be involved with a particular venue, you may be a producer locally, let them know that. Let them know what your background is, too, because that might be helpful in putting this particular puzzle together. Can you tell us the name of the book again?
The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry.
Wow, and that's coming out in October.
In October. It should actually be available for pre-order pretty soon, if it's not already.
How would you best like people to get the book? Through what means? Through Amazon?
What I would love is if... I'm glad you asked that question. If people would pre-order it from whatever book dealer they like to buy books from, it could be like your local independent bookseller, if you support a local independent bookseller, which I, of course, encourage you to do, or it can be through one of the big online companies, of course. But independent bookstores are tracked. Their sales do count.
Great. So that's a way that immediately you could begin to support this project, because if the bookstores start hearing about it months in advance, that's going to pique their interest. And when the book salesman comes around with his catalog, they're going to say, well, yeah, get some of those.
Yeah, I mean, I know authors who spend a lot of energy trying to get their pre-orders as high as they can. I haven't quite reached that level of marketing intensity yet, but I do encourage people to buy it as soon as possible.
Okay, well, we're going to have on the same page right below, we have our audio player, of course, where you're listening to this, and then right below there, we're going to have the links to all the major online sellers. But if you are a supporter of independent bookselling, and I hope you are, take this information to your local bookseller. Let them know that the book is coming, that you're interested in it, that you want a copy, and that would be a great way for our Jasmine subscribers and fans and listeners to support this project in its most early stages. So, Ned, thank you for taking the time. I know you've got a lot to do. You're one of the busiest men in show business. And
thank you so much, Ken. It's so nice of you to take this time to talk to me about this.
Oh, my pleasure, really. I know we've been following the progress on this book for a couple of years now. I'm very excited.
Oh, man. It's longer, more years than you even realize. It just sort of stretches out.
Right. So, everybody, that's Ned Sublett, and all the information about the book is going to appear right on this same page. And I want to thank Ned again.
Thank you.
And for your books, by the way. They are treasures. I have them always close to me, and they're always filling in my understanding of the music that I love and that I listen to all the time. So, for everybody, for Jazz on the Tube, we'll see you next time.
Thank you.